Today's episode is sponsored in part by Modern Mammals, creators of a new hair washing product for men. You can help support Based on a True Story when you use the code BOATSPODCAST at modernmammals.com for 10% off. I've really been enjoying their shampoo light bar as an alternative to traditional shampoo. And I know it's in the name, but honestly, when I first used it, I was surprised at just how light and airy it feels. It reminds me of using a bar of soap for your hair, except it's even better than that because if you're like me, you don't like the residue that some actual bars of soap leave behind. And the shampoo light bar is easy to wash out without leaving any residue behind. Modern Mammals also focuses on creating products that help you keep your hair's natural oils so it's not left feeling poofy and frizzy. Go to modernmammals.com and use code BOATSPODCAST for 10% off. Again, that's modernmammals.com for 10% off with promo code BOATSPODCAST. Don't forget to use the promo code BOATSPODCAST so they know I sent you. Thanks, Modern Mammals. Okay, let's start today's episode. Hello, and welcome to Based on a True Story, the podcast that compares your favorite Hollywood movies and TV shows with history. On today's episode, we're continuing our series on the HBO miniseries Chernobyl. There are 5 episodes in HBO's miniseries, so there will be 5 episodes in our series as well. And today, we're going to look at episode number 4, which is called The Happiness of All Mankind. This episode originally aired on May 27th, 2019. Since this is episode 4 of the series, if you haven't already, I would highly recommend going back to listen to when we looked at the first 3 episodes. We cover a lot of the story up until now, so we won't be repeating a lot of that information again. Instead, we're going to be building on it as needed for this episode and the rest of the series. You can find all the episodes for this series over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/Chernobyl. Before we start our story today, though, let's set up our game, 2 Truths and a Lie. If you're new to the show, here's how it works. I'm about to say 3 things. 2 of them are true, and that means one of them is an all-out lie. Are you ready? Okay, here they are. Number 1, the cleanup effort on Unit 3 was done by soldiers in 12 days. Number 2, they really did have to shoot household pets in Pripyat. Number 3, the accident at Chernobyl was the first nuclear accident in the Soviet Union. Got them? Okay, now as you're listening to our story today, your challenge is to identify which one of those is the lie. And of course, we'll do a recap at the end of the episode to see how well you did. So, how much of the 4th episode of Chernobyl really happened? I'm Dan Lefebvre, and this is Based on a True Story. A soldier is trying to get a woman to evacuate the radiation area. She refuses. She says she's 82 and has lived here her whole life. Why should she care if it's safe or not? She says she was 12 when the revolution came. Tsar's men, then Bolsheviks. They told us to leave. Then there was Stalin and his famine, the Holodomor. My parents died and 2 of my sisters. They told the rest of us to leave. No. Then the Great War. German boys, Russian boys, more soldiers, more famine, more bodies. So I should leave now because of something I cannot see at all? No. While I couldn't find anything in my research to suggest this introductory sequence was based on a specific person, what it depicts was something that's very real. Not everyone wanted to leave the area. That's probably not too surprising, though. It's still common for people to not want to leave their homes when natural disasters like hurricanes are bearing down on them. Being 82 years old means she's talking about a revolution 70 years before the time period of the series, since she said she was 12 when that happened. Since that time period is 1986, 70 years earlier would be 1916. And that's close enough to the Russian Revolution of 1917, so I'm going to guess that's the revolution she's referring to. There's way too much to cover in this episode about that. But in a nutshell, the Russian government was not doing well during World War I. That was from 1914 to 1918. In February of 1917, there was a revolution in Russia that basically ended with Tsar Nicholas II abdicating the throne. That ended about 300 years of the Romanov dynasty ruling over Russia since 1613 with the first Tsar, Ivan the Terrible. If the name Romanov sounds familiar, you might be thinking of the story of Anastasia. That would be Tsar Nicholas II's daughter. So the government changed from a monarchy to, well, kind of chaos for a while. Remember, that revolution would have been in February. That was until September. That was when Russia declared it was a democratic republic. That didn't last long, though, because in October of 1917, there was another revolution that saw Vladimir Lenin's Bolshevik Party take power. So that's why the lady is talking about the Tsar's men and then the Bolsheviks. She also mentioned Stalin's famine, the Holodomor. We learned more about that when we learned about the movie Bitter Harvest back on episode number 40. And then again, with insights from the screenwriter of the movie in episode number 57 of Based on a True Story. That was a man-made famine in 1932 and 1933 when the Soviet Union, led by Joseph Stalin at the time, forced unrealistic grain quotas that led to the famine. Since Ukraine was one of the largest grain-producing states in the USSR, they were hit especially hard. We don't know the exact amount of people who died, but estimations range between 3.5 and 10 million people, most of them in Ukraine. Today, Ukraine recognizes Holodomor as a genocide carried out by the Soviet regime. The next thing mentioned by the woman is the Great War with German and Russian soldiers. Even though a lot of people referred to World War I as the Great War, I don't think that's what she was talking about. World War I was taking place at the same time as the revolution she mentioned at the very beginning in 1917. Then she seems to go in order of historical events. So mentioning the Great War at the end would have been after Holodomor in the early 1930s. That makes me think she's talking about World War II. During World War II, the Germans occupied much of Ukraine after Operation Barbarossa when the Germans invaded. While Chernobyl technically existed, it wasn't really what it was in 1986, because it wasn't until the 1970s when it was picked for the nuclear power plant. So there weren't a lot of residents in the area during World War II. Most of the residents at the time were Jewish. And with the Germans invading and occupying the area until 1943, sadly, that means most of them were murdered in the Holocaust. Perhaps the most well-known incident happened at Babi Yar, a ravine located just outside Kyiv at about 133 kilometers or 82 miles away from Chernobyl. It was there on September 29th and September 30th in 1941 that the Nazis murdered 33,371 Jews in one of the first massacres of the war. Didn't stop there, though. Throughout the war, the location was used for continual murdering by the Nazis, so much so that by the end of the war, it's estimated between 100,000 and 150,000 Jews, Roma, and Soviet prisoners and others were murdered there. For the purposes of our story today, I think it's moving to hear how it's possible for a single person, like the woman at the beginning of the episode, whether or not that's based on an actual person is kind of irrelevant, because it's moving to hear how a single person could have lived through so many horrors and atrocities in that area. And after seeing so many horrible things, now they're supposed to run away because of something they can't even see. We can understand why some would be hesitant. As I'm recording this right now, on the other side of my door is my cat. He's always wherever I am as I'm working on the podcast. He watches all the movies with me, and he lets me know when it's time to stop working by sitting on my keyboard. I love the little guy. And as a pet owner, that means there are expenses like vet bills that can pop up, and sometimes it's unexpected. That's why I was happy to learn about today's sponsor, EarnIn, because they can help make sure that I've got the money to cover those unexpected vet bills. EarnIn is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day, or up to $750 per pay period. Now you can join over 3.5 million customers. Get the peace of mind that comes with EarnIn. Download EarnIn today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the EarnIn app, type in True Story under podcast when you sign up. It'll really help the show. True Story under podcast. EarnIn is a financial technology company, not a bank. Subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC. Thanks, EarnIn. Back in the series, we see a time and place on the screen. It's August of 1986 in Kiev, or Kyiv now. That's 4 months after the explosion. Ludmila Ignatenko enters a building with another lady. There's not a lot of explanation here, but it looks like she's moving into an apartment. The impression I got from the series, though, was that people from Pripyat were relocated to Kyiv. Granted, we don't see any of the other people from Pripyat relocating. We only see Ludmila entering a new or at least an empty apartment. But then again, the series focused more on Ludmila and Vasily than it did other townspeople in Pripyat. So the impression I got was that people were moving there. In either case, what we do know from history is that after the town of Pripyat was evacuated, everyone was moved elsewhere. A new city named Slodovich was built just for the evacuees of Pripyat. It's located about 30 miles or 45 kilometers from Pripyat. However, with that said, in the timeline of the series, no one was living at Slodovich yet. Construction on that city, remember, this was, they didn't expect to move. Construction on that city was started in October of 1986. And then the first residents didn't move in until 1988. So because the evacuation of Pripyat happened on April 27th, 1986, a day after the explosion, the residents did have to stay somewhere in the interim, and they kind of, not everybody stayed at the same place necessarily. If we go back to the series, one of the most heart-wrenching sequences happens next. It's when three soldiers, Pavel, Bacho, and Garo, go around the now abandoned city to shoot any animals they find. Most of them are lovable pets who were left behind in the evacuation and are just excited to see a human again. There's one especially sad scene where Pavel comes across a dog with her puppies in a house. They're so cute, but they must be killed to avoid spreading radiation. They've been ordered to shoot the animals while others are digging up the ground and others still are cutting down trees. This is all a part of a cleanup effort, trying to get rid of any radiation on the plants and the top of the ground, as well as killing any poisoned animals before they spread the radiation further or die horrific deaths themselves because of the radiation poisoning. While I couldn't find anything in my research to suggest things happened exactly like we do in the series with Pavel, Bacho, and Garo, the essence of what we're seeing here is true, if perhaps simplified for the series. There were 40 men who took to the streets to hunt the pets. They weren't keen on going to the radiation zone at first, since they weren't given anything to protect themselves against the radiation, but they did what they had to do. At first, the pets did exactly like we see them doing in the series, as they'd run up to people, excited. Then they'd scatter at the sound of the guns. Before long, many of the animals stopped trusting the humans and it got more difficult to find them. That scene with the dog and the puppies, it happened more than once. In the book, Voices from Chernobyl, one of the hunters recounts the story of finding a dog with her puppies and how he shot them one by one. There's a story of an older lady in there as well who had shut herself in her house instead of evacuating. She had three dogs and five cats, and the men forced most of them away from her despite her screams and protests. They left one cat and one dog. Maybe she was the older lady they based on the beginning of the episode, but there's nothing that I could find to validate that specifically. All the animals were collected and buried in mass graves. The graves were supposed to be lined with plastic or protected in some way to keep the bodies from decomposing into the groundwater, kind of like what we heard happened to Vasily Ignatenko and some of the other first responders, but that didn't happen for the pets. They were put in the ground and covered with dirt. Most of the time, they were already dead. One of the hunters recalled an instance where a dog was only injured, but they didn't have any bullets left to kill it, so they buried it alive. Before the evacuation, everyone was told they'd be back within a few days. They weren't. For 2 months, the hunters drove around the streets taking out the household pets. Horses were put down. But not necessarily all the animals were killed. One of the hunters recalls they left the pigs alive. Otters they let free so they could swim away in a nearby river. Still, it must have been devastating to have to do that. While not as prominent in the series, we do see some of the other cleanup effort as well, cutting down trees, digging up the earth, and so on. All of that happened too. But of course, there is more to the story than we see in the series. For 30 kilometers, that's about 18 miles, around the Chernobyl power plant, the military was in charge of cleanup. Houses, cars, buildings, roads, trees, literally everything was deemed contaminated and needed to be cleaned. To do this, they'd first spray things down. We saw some of that in this series too. Something else we see is helicopters dropping something on the trees. While I was watching that, I wasn't sure exactly what the liquid was for. There wasn't a fire, so it wasn't like they were dropping water to put out wildfires. So I thought perhaps it was to kill the trees to make them easier to chop down. That was just what I assumed while I was watching it because it didn't really explain what it was. But after researching it more, I was wrong. It wasn't to kill the trees. What they were dropping from helicopters was a liquid solution that they called water soup. The purpose of it wasn't really to decontaminate or kill anything or to do anything other than to be a liquid that would make any radioactive materials adhere to the surface. Imagine you're driving down a dirt road and the dust gets kicked up and then it settles somewhere else. This process was similar. There was going to be a lot of cleanup and they wanted to avoid any radioactive or any other materials getting kicked up by the next phase of the cleanup. That next phase involved spraying a special decontaminating agent on anything and everything, grass, plants, cars, mechanical equipment, houses, any structures, pretty much everything. If something was beyond being decontaminated, it would be destroyed or buried. Entire buildings and structures were buried to limit the continued contamination. And that last part especially would certainly kick up a lot of radioactive material and things you don't want to be flying around as you're trying to clean up the area. So that's why they dropped that water soup on there, as they called it. An entire forest was cut down too. It was about 10 square kilometers or a little under 4 square miles. So not a huge forest, but enough to be a big job. That was nicknamed the Red Forest because the trees were so affected by the radiation from the explosion that they actually turned red. If we go back into the series now, Ulana Kumyuk is continuing her investigation into what happened. She pulls some documents from the KGB archive. It got redacted some before she was allowed to access it. And then after Anatoly Dyatlov refused to talk to her in the last episode, this time he's finally willing to talk. Kumyuk brings the document. In their dialogue, we find out the document is from 1976, and it talks about RBMK reactors under extreme conditions. But they forgot to redact the table of contents. So Kumyuk points out some of the pages they did redact are talking about a positive void coefficient and the AZ5 button. That seems to be of interest because she knows they pressed the AZ5 button and then the reactor exploded. Dyatlov says void coefficients have nothing to do with AZ5 and then tells her that she's looking for answers, but even the right question won't find the truth. There is no truth. You'll only get lies in return for your questions and I'll get the bullet. As we learned throughout this series, Kumyuk is a fictional character. So of course the specifics of this scene are made up, but this brings up a great point because even though we learned what the AZ5 button was already, There's a new term the HBO miniseries talks about here that we haven't really explained in our own series yet. Void coefficients. What are they? And was Dyatlov correct in the series to talk about how they have nothing to do with the AZ-5 button? Okay, to start, a void coefficient is not unique to the reactors at Chernobyl. A void coefficient is just a way of measuring how a reactor changes as voids are introduced. The voids are things like steam bubbles in the water. And the measurement is basically to know if the void coefficient is positive or negative. If it's negative, that means it'll be less reactive. And if it's positive, then it'll be more reactive. For an RBMK reactor type, the void coefficient is extremely positive. So that's why it needed to be monitored closely. How about the idea of the void coefficient having nothing to do with AZ-5? That's not entirely true. But that doesn't mean the series was wrong when it suggests Dyatlov thought it was true at the time. If you've listened to the first few episodes in the series, you'll know there was nothing in the training on RBMK reactors in the Soviet Union at the time to suggest anything otherwise. However, looking at this from a historical perspective, now we know that's not true. We talked about this before, so I won't go in depth explaining what AZ-5 does again. But the reason it's not true has to do with the design of the control rods because they are tipped with graphite. Going back to the series, there's another date on the screen. It's September of 1986 now, and they're still trying to clear the roof of debris. Boris Shcherbina makes some calls and gets a police robot nicknamed Joker from West Germany. After lowering the robots to the roof of the reactor by helicopter, we see Shcherbina and Valery Legasov in the control room with a bunch of monitors. They decide to start by testing the robot's functions. Good signal. Motors are good. Move 1 meter forward. All good. Okay, now let's go 1 meter backward. Wait a second. It just died. In the control room, all the buttons go from green to red. Is that the signal? No, the signal's fine. There's so much radiation, the robot itself died. That's all true. Although, again, there's more to the story that we don't see in the series. The plan was not one that Shcherbina or Legasov came up with themselves, but rather it came from technicians at the Ministry of Energy. Joker was a real vehicle they bought from West Germany. It was specifically designed to handle radioactive material. And the plan was to use it alongside two other rovers that were developed for the Soviet Lunar Exploration Program. We see that kind of briefly mentioned in the series as well. But they didn't want to pick anything up and move it elsewhere because that would just create another contaminated site that they'd have to deal with. So instead, what they wanted to do was exactly what we see in the series: push the radioactive debris off the roof of Unit 3 and back into where the core of Unit 4 used to be. That way they could lower the radioactivity enough to build a roof over the whole thing and seal it off. That was the plan. Just like we see in the series, Joker and the other rovers were not up to the task. They all failed. So it was back to the drawing board. The date was September 16th when the commission met in Shcherbina's office to decide what to do next. They had to clean the rooftops if they ever wanted to build that huge metal and concrete roof, something they called a sarcophagus, over the top of it and seal it off. It was just too dangerous to build if the rooftops weren't cleared of radioactive materials first. And their attempts at using remote vehicles failed miserably. There was only one option left to clean up the radioactivity. It was too dangerous for machines to do. Everyone in the room knew what that meant. Humans had to do it. Back in the series, we see text on the screen saying it's October 1986. General Tarakhanov gives a bunch of soldiers instructions on how they're going to clean it up. Russia needs it done. You'll have 90 seconds to solve the problem. Enter through the reactor building number 3 and climb the stairs to the roof. When you get to the top, wait for a moment to catch your breath. When you enter the work area, look for the graphite. Some of the blocks might be 40 to 50 kilograms. That's about 90 to 110 pounds. And it all must be thrown over the edge in a specific spot. He points to a photo of the roof showing where they're going to throw the graphite over so that it lands in Unit 4. After 90 seconds, a bell will ring and you'll return immediately. Go back down the stairs for decontamination. And not to get too far ahead of our story today, but at the end of the episode, we see General Tarakhanov thanking what he says are, quote, the last of 3,828 men, end quote. This recreation of how the cleanup process went is pretty accurate. Although it didn't start in October like this series suggests, and it also didn't end after December like this series kind of implies, because it shows that scene with General Tarakhanov at the end, and that scene comes after we see some text on the screen with the date of December 1986, and then there's a conversation between Shcherbina, Legasov, and Kumyuk. We'll get to that conversation in a minute, but because we see that date, and then later on we see the scene with General Tarakhanov at the end, it kind of gives the impression that the cleanup process went until December. In reality, the cleanup operation started just 3 days after the decision was made to use humans, or biorobots, as the planners called them. And as we learned a moment ago, that decision was made on September 16th. We don't see this in the series at all, but before anyone went onto the roof to clean things up, someone had to go up there first to do a test, basically to figure out the plan. That was done by a radiologist in the Medical Army Corps who wore protective gear that included pieces made from hastily torn down lead from the walls of the government offices in Chernobyl, along with 10 different decimeters to monitor the radiation levels. He sprinted across the roof of Unit 3 and threw 5 shovelfuls of graphite over the edge to the remains of Unit 4 before sprinting back. He was on the roof for 73 seconds. In that time, he absorbed 15 rem. That's about 3 times what the U.S. federal government considers to be safe to be absorbed in an entire year. General Tarakhanov was a real person, and he was in charge of the soldiers tasked with doing the cleanup. He gave each soldier the chance not to go. There were some who didn't want to go, but they also recognized they were the last chance. If they didn't do it, no one else would. In the end, no one refused to go. On the afternoon of September 19th, the first wave of soldiers began the bulk of the work. It was work that lasted for 12 hours a day and for 12 days until October 1st. They were armed with shovels, rakes, wooden stretchers to carry larger pieces of graphite, and sledgehammers to break out pieces that had been melted into the bitumen. The time of 90 seconds we see in the series is a simplification. They were trying to limit each person's exposure to no more than 25 rem. But they did use a bell or a siren when the time was up. Each soldier's contribution was meticulously logged. One person threw down 3 pieces of graphite weighing up to 200 kilograms, or about 440 pounds. Another threw down 7 pipes that weighed up to 30 kilograms or 67 pounds. Each soldier was supposed to go on the roof only once, but some went again. At the end of the cleanup operation on the roof of Unit 3, just like we see in the series, there were 3 men who climbed to the top of the chimney to raise a red flag. That was done to signal the cleanup was finished. There are photographs of the men attaching the flag to the top of the chimney taken by war photographer Igor Kostin. I'll include those in the resources for this episode over on the show's website. As a quick little side note, Kostin was one of the few photographers to document the accident. His photographs are some of the only surviving images of Unit 4 just a few hours after the explosion. Many of his photos didn't survive due to the radiation, while others were so heavily affected by it that the radiation itself is visible in the film. I would highly recommend you look at his photographs to get an idea of what an absolute mess the whole area was after the explosion. If we go back to the series, it's December of 1986 now. There's a brief mention in the dialogue between Shcherbina, Legasov, and Kumyuk about Legasov going to Vienna to speak to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Before he does that, though, Kumyuk wants to tell him what she's discovered about what happened. She shows him the document that she also showed to Dyatlov earlier in the episode That's the heavily redacted document that talks about a tie between the AZ-5 button and the void coefficient in RBMK reactors. To her surprise, Agesov already seems to know about this. He tells Kumyuk about an RBMK reactor in Leningrad back in 1975 that had a fuel channel rupture. The operators pressed AZ-5 and the power went up first before it went down. In the series, Legasov mentions a colleague named Volkov, who wrote the article Kumyuk found. Vladimir Volkov was a real person. He was the head of the Kurchatov Institute's RBMK Safety Research Group. I've mentioned this before, and of course, as you already know, since the composite character of Kumyuk is involved in this, that's not something that really happened exactly like we see in the series. But the idea of something happening in Leningrad in 1975 is real. And it didn't have to be found by someone from the commission in some KGB archive, because someone who was there for the Leningrad accident was also at Chernobyl. He's not in the series at all, but Vitaly Boryets was one of the most experienced nuclear engineers in the Soviet Union at the time. In November of 1975, he was working at the Chernobyl power plant when he took a business trip to Leningrad for some training at an RBMK reactor, some 50 kilometers or about 30 miles outside the city of Leningrad. On November 30th, he was stopping the reactor and shifting to another mode of operation when he noticed something was wrong. As the reactor slowed to a lower power level, inserting the control rods to slow the reaction didn't actually slow the reaction like it was supposed to. In fact, it did the exact opposite. The nuclear reaction was increasing rapidly. They managed to avoid an explosion by using the AZ-5 emergency shutdown, but not before one of the fuel channels melted, releasing radiation into the air. We still don't know exactly how that affected the people of Leningrad. The issue had to do with the design of the control rods. They were 6 meters long, or just under 20 feet. Because of the graphite tips, when they were inserted into the core at a depth less than 2 meters, or about 6.5 feet, they caused a spike in the radiation. This issue, as well as the incident at the Leningrad power plant, was something the Soviet government kept under wraps. What they did do was to give orders to change the control rods and RBMK reactors in the Soviet Union to avoid the issue from happening again. They did that after the accident at Leningrad. Although, they didn't say why they were making the changes, so no one at Chernobyl really thought it was a big deal. It was just an order to make a change. And they did make the change in Unit 3 at Chernobyl, but they hadn't gotten around to doing it yet in Unit 4. However, because Boryets happened to be there when it happened in Leningrad, he knew there could be an issue. Even though he didn't know the full extent of why it happened, only that it did. By the time 1986 rolled around, it was an incident that happened over 10 years earlier, so it wasn't something that was on the top of his mind as he helped plan the test at Chernobyl. After the explosion, of course, that was a different story. Speaking of the story, there's also more to the story of Legasov going to Vienna that we don't see in the series. The timeline in the series is a bit off because it talks about Legasov going to Vienna during a conversation that supposedly happened in December of 1986. In truth, Legasov went to Vienna in August, so from August 25th to the 29th in 1986. He was the head of the Soviet Union's delegation to explain to the International Atomic Energy Agency what had happened at Chernobyl. While he was there, Legasov presented a report on the disaster and answered questions for over 3 hours from scientists of other countries. Of course, not all the details were included in the report. That report basically blamed operator error and left out the issues with the reactor design. Not only that, but the report was prohibited from being seen back in the Soviet Union. So that meant there were people around the world who knew more about the disaster than those who were working on it. Later, Legasov admitted to playing a part in the cover-up of information when he said, "I did not lie in Vienna, but I did not tell the full truth." This episode of Based on a True Story was written and produced by me, Dan Lefebvre. If you want to learn more about the true story, I have a lot of great resources that I found in my research, from overall articles and timelines and explanations to technical papers written by scientists and engineers who have spent years studying the disaster. All those are found at the show's home on the web. As I mentioned before, there were three books in particular that I loved and found super helpful in researching this entire series. One is called simply Chernobyl by Serhiy Plokhiy. Midnight in Chernobyl is another one by Adam Higginbotham. And then last but certainly not least, there's not really an order to these, Chernobyl 1-23-40, the incredible true story of the world's worst nuclear disaster by Andrew Leatherbarrow. While they're all great books individually, I would also recommend reading all of them because, as you'd expect from any story in history, each perspective uncovers different details. Just like this podcast series won't ever be able to tell the story in its entirety, no single book can do that either. So I would recommend checking them all out if you can. You can find links to those books, all the resources, and follow the entire Chernobyl series in one place over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/Chernobyl. That's where all the episodes will be posted as they're released. Okay, now it's time for the answer to our two truths and a lie game from the beginning of the episode. And as a refresher, here are the two truths and one lie. Number one, the soldiers' cleanup effort on Unit 3 was done in 12 days. Number two, they really did have to shoot household pets in Pripyat. Number three, the accident at Chernobyl was the first nuclear accident in the Soviet Union. Did you find out which one is a lie? Let's start with number one. The cleanup effort on Unit 3 was done by soldiers in 12 days. That is true. As we learned, after vehicles like Joker and the Rovers failed to function in the extreme radiation, 3,868 soldiers manually cleaned it up. They started on the afternoon of September 19th, and for 12 hours a day, they worked until it was completed on October 1st, 12 days later. Next is number two. They really did have to shoot household pets in Pripyat. Sadly, this is also true. Because of the exposure levels and risk of spreading the contamination, the military had teams of hunters who went into Pripyat and killed the infected animals. And that means the lie is number three. The accident at Chernobyl was the first nuclear accident in the Soviet Union. While Chernobyl was obviously the biggest accident, not just in the Soviet Union, but the entire world up till that point, we learned that an RBMK reactor in Leningrad also had an accident in 1975, about 9 years earlier. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I really hope you're enjoying this series so far. If you found it entertaining, if you find value in this podcast and you'd like to give a little of that value back, you can do that over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/support. Once again, that's basedonatruestorypodcast.com/support. Until next time, thanks so much for listening, and I'll chat with you again really soon.